Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
All right, it is Tuesday morning, 8 o'clock. Rich Kasten over here alongside Ryan McPherson. And stepping up to bat, Emily Rao, the host for Atlanta Legal Experts. And now it's the Rich and Ryan show for this morning's episode. And we want to thank all our listeners for tuning in to Atlanta Legal Experts. It's the place to be found if you're in the legal profession. And we just want to kind of go round table real quick and just say hi and welcome to our guest. And if you would just kind of introduce yourself, maybe tell just a little bit about your field of expertise, what you might be sharing about this morning, and we'll kind of jump into some questions. So first, David, if you want to kick things off. And
good morning. I'm David Garfinkel. I practice with Levine, Smith, Snyder, and Wilson. I've been practicing family law for 33 years, primarily for the first 28 years in combined Alabama and Florida. And recently, I moved to Atlanta.
Okay.
And I am dealing strictly in family law.
Nice. I was born in Miami, raised in Central Florida. What part, any part of Florida that you kind of worked throughout? Or
I worked from Orlando upward to the north part of the state with an office in Jacksonville.
Okay, nice. And I also will just invite our guest as well to maybe let our listeners know at the top of the hour the best way to reach yourself, you know, reach out to your practice or your firm, website, Twitter handle, phone number, home address, social security number, whatever you want to give out. But so, David, how would listeners find out about you?
Levine, Smith, Snyder, and Wilson website, www.lsswlaw.com.
Okay, perfect. And we'll obviously post all this information on the website as well. So our next guest joining us in the studio is Allison. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Okay. I have my law degree here in the state of Georgia. And then I also have my PhD in clinical psychology. So my practice specializes in helping families and children go through the process of divorce, which can include anything from child custody evaluations, parental fitness evaluations, therapy with children who are going through the process of divorce, and things like that. And with a group, Peachtree Psychological Associates, we specialize in helping high-conflict families through the process of divorce, and we also have a website online.
Okay, great. And do you know the website handle offhand, or we'll post that or have that. I think we have it on our information as well. Ryan may pull that up in here in a moment. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, and to my left, as if radio listeners can make those correlations, but Amy's joining us in the studio. Good morning.
Hi, I'm Amy Kay, and I'm a partner at Ellis Funk, and I do exclusively family law and also serve as a guardian ad litem.
Oh, okay. Tell us a little bit about guardian ad litems.
Well, when there is a custody dispute, typically mom has a lawyer, dad has a lawyer, and a third lawyer can be appointed to represent the best interests of the children and help in the custody determination. The judge always decides custody, but a guardian would do an investigation and make a recommendation to the court, but the ultimate decision rests with the court. When I first started doing guardian work, a judge once described to me, she said that the guardian is the eyes and ears of the court.
Okay.
That the judge can't come off the bench and do an investigation, and that's the guardian's job to do that, to speak to witnesses, speak to the parties, and make a recommendation back.
All right. Well said. And so let's kind of get into some of the questions to kind of kick off the show. And again, you're listening to Atlanta Legal Experts, or affectionately known as AL Radio. And so let's jump off. We have a first question to kind of tee up. I'm going to throw this one to Allison. So talk to us about the emphasis about, you know, should a court place on the presence of parental alienation when it makes a custody determination? I mean, how would you, define that? We'll start with parental alienation.
Yeah, we can start there. This is a pretty hot topic, I think, right now in a lot of family law cases. And it's evolved in the research over the years. Richard Gardner was the first person who kind of defined parental alienation, and he had a conceptualization, but even his conceptualization of alienation has come under a lot of criticism recently, and most of us are now focusing on more of a spectrum that has been kind of put forth by researchers Kelly and Johnson. And the spectrum suggests that a child's relationship with a parent is on a continuum. We can have an allied child who is very close to a parent. We can have kind of a neutral child who is kind of ambivalent about seeing one parent or the other, or we can have at the other end of the spectrum what we would call kind of the alienated child, where a child is actually rejecting a parent with no ambivalence and is kind of experiencing the parent in a way that's kind of out of touch with reality and has very harsh feelings towards the parent, which may or may not be warranted.
Who determines the, if they're warranted or not? I mean, that's kind of complicated, right?
Absolutely. I think we need to consider multiple factors. Usually one parent will come in and say, the other parent is alienating the child against me. And the reality is you need to talk to the child. Right. You need to talk to the parent that's making the accusation, and you need to talk to the parent that maybe is doing the quote-unquote alienating.
Right.
Because there are many factors. There are child factors, temperament, age, gender, any of those at different times. Children are closer to one or the other of their parents. There's situational factors. Often children are put in a high conflict divorce that we need to consider. And we need to consider the characteristics of each of the parents. Maybe the parent that's feeling rejected by the child actually did something to cause an estrangement between the parent and the child. So we need to kind of take a big step back and look at a lot of different factors when considering it.
Can you ever bring in an unbiased, it's not possible, but probably a third party, like another, family member outside of the immediate household, like grandparents or, siblings would be in-house, but could they shed some new light or some, clergy people or,
That's where sometimes the role of a guardian interacts with the psychologist, because I'll tell you that the term parental alienation is sometimes used very loosely by parents, and that if a parent will say to the guardian, my ex or soon to be ex is alienating the children from me, and that's a very strong term, and that word has really psychological definition, as Allison was just describing. Sometimes the parents using that term loosely just, they're saying something bad about me, and they then say they're alienated. But true parental alienation rises to a much higher level. So the investigation, a lot falls on the guardian to speak to these other witnesses, as you're describing, to speak to other people who have watched the parents with the children to see how they interact and things that maybe are being said to the children. And that's where there can be psychological testing and interviews by someone like Allison, who's professionally trained, as well as someone like myself as a guardian, to go and do that investigation and talk to these third-party witnesses.
Intermediate word, or is there something, a lower threshold? Because it does seem like alienation. I mean, that's like, there's not a lot of gray area there in terms of the civilian interpretation, if you will.
Well, and I think an important distinction that we try to make in our field is a difference between alienation and what we might call estrangement or realistic estrangement.
Okay.
And you have parents at times, especially in these situations when they are not functioning very well, making parenting errors, as we would describe them. And their children naturally kind of pull back from them in that moment. That's not alienation. That's what we would call estrangement. The child is responding to what the parent is putting out there. So what we want to do is kind of educate the parent about what are you contributing to it? What is the child contributing to it? What is the other parent contributing to it? All of these different things.
A lot of moving parts. I think, David, you're going to jump in with it.
I've often had a judge ask me, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to rope tie the child and drag him to the other parent's house? A lot of times there's been allegations of alleged, actual, and
inappropriate,
false allegations of sexual and physical and emotional abuse, and the child doesn't want to see the other parent, rightfully or wrongfully, and the judge asks, what remedies are available? What do you want me to do? And from a guardian standpoint, what recommendation would you make?
There's also what we sometimes refer to as reunification therapy, but a lot of times we send the parent and the child to someone like Allison for counseling together so that they can better communicate with each other. And I think that's one of the things that Allison was mentioning earlier. Sometimes the other parent is in fact doing something that separates the child from the other parent. Sometimes it's that parent, him or herself, who has done something that has upset the child that they may not realize, but they have to own the fact that they need to be responsible for their own relationship with the child. And so sometimes sending the child who's having a problem with a particular parent to therapy with that parent, that they can learn to get on the same page. And sometimes they're mad, like you were saying, they're mad about the divorce. They're mad, how come dad left or mom left? How come whatever's happening in our family, and they, for whatever reason, blame a parent, whether the other parent told them to blame them or not. The children come up with their own decisions. So that's one thing I think that the therapy is one, and a very simple one is just to tell that parent you need to spend some time with that child. You need to have some one-on-one time, and you need to reconnect with that child. Sometimes as parents, we kind of take for granted our relationship with our children, which is a bad thing to do.
I've seen judges say, well, the child's 14 years old. I'm not going to make the child go. And even if it's false allegations, I'm just not going to get involved.
Well, what we know in terms of, you know, long-term outcomes, what the research consistently says is children have the worst outcomes depending on if the level of conflict between the parents stays high. So I think psychologists, the first thing we want to do is kind of try to mitigate and minimize that conflict and try to have an acceptable relationship with both parents. It might not be ideal. It might not be ideal to the parent, but if a child, especially at certain developmental ages, has contact with both parents, absent serious abuse or, you know, incompetent parenting, that will give the child the best outcomes. And sometimes even telling both parents, it will be best for your kid if your child has a relationship with both of you, can get them on board with the process as well.
And I have to qualify, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not even playing one on the radio, right? But but does this make sense? If you can kind of quiet that storm amongst the parents, then does that kind of give you a better true indication of the child's personality and their interpretation of the sequence of events?
Yes, or? And you raise a good point, and we do this in our practice a lot. The reunification therapy is one piece, but you can't just do that in a vacuum because it is a system. As I said, there are many factors that have been contributing. So usually if I'm doing reunification, I make sure each of the parents has an individual therapist that they can talk to, that I'm in contact with. I make sure that maybe there's what we would call a co-parenting counselor who's managing their relationship and trying to keep the conflict low. And we all collaborate together because it's the same system, but we're all kind of focusing on different pieces to try and make the overall outcome a little better.
And the co-parenting is an important part of it. And as you were saying, I think we see that a lot. If the parents can get along better, it takes a lot of pressure off the children, and things for the family as a whole usually gets better if the parents can get along better. So a lot of times we send the parents to co-parenting counseling or have what Allison is referring to as a parent coordinator to help them learn to communicate better with each other and take the pressure off their children.
Absolutely. That makes sense.
Ryan McPherson here. Just jump in with a couple of questions for you, Amy. Talking about the parent alienation, and what are some of those remedies the court should consider, and what choices do they have?
Well, it's hard, as David was saying, because when a child gets to a certain age, you know, it's hard to just force a teenager. There's certain things we can do as a parent. I'm the parent, and you are going to go do this. And certainly the parents, I mean, sometimes I think parents throw up their hands too quickly and just say, oh, well, I can't, he doesn't want to go see dad, so I'm just not, I can't make him. What are we going to do? I think, you know, the judge can order the parent that you need to try to get him there, but realistically, there are limits to what you, once a child reaches a certain age. It's certainly easier with younger children. I mean, the judge is going to specifically answer your question, the judge is going to order a parenting time schedule. So okay. That's what the judge is going to do. But the judge is not going to go home with these people and make sure that the child gets into the car and that the child, in fact, gets to the other parent. So there are limits, as David was saying, to what the court can do.
Would they ever consider change of custody or anything like that?
I've seen several times where a judge changes custody, and I find that to be troubling, especially if the child is actually does not have a strong bond with the parent that actually gets the custody. I've seen judges put a very stringent program. There's one that I know of called Family Bridges, where the child actually goes with the non-alienating parent for a period of 90 days with actually no contact with the alienating parent.
Well, usually those situations and when the change of custody is ordered is when the residential parent has severe pathology and is really contributing. Those are in those classic alienation cases where that what we would term the allied parent is really kind of feeding the child a lot of messages about the other parent. And because of that parent's pathology, it's important to remove the child from that influence. But if you have a healthy parent, hopefully everyone can get on board with increasing access plans. And, you know, with adolescents, I've had a lot of success. The more control they have, the better. So if you need a ride to this, well, your dad's going to take you, even though you don't like to see your dad. So, you know, you kind of work out these negotiations and increase contact and kind of not, you know, normal parenting plan ways, but ways that work for the kid and work for the parents.
Talk to us about personality disorders and how does that impact, you know, the ability to parent. I mean, narcissism, I mean, there's a whole list, right?
There are, and those are another thing, you know, I mean, when we talk about what parents come in, they all say, they're alienating, or they have a personality disorder, I think he's a narcissist, I think she right, has right. borderline personality.
Because they saw it on TV right. or whatever, right?
Yeah, that's right. Right.
do what you know how to do, right?
Yeah. Right. And I think, you know, personality disorders are like any mental health disorder. They can impact parenting.
Sure.
And I think what we try to do in custody evaluation, parental fitness evaluation, working with the guardians who might think there's an underlying mental health concern, we try to establish if it's kind of what we would call state versus trait situation. Is this kind of what we would see as a chronic trait they have? Is this characterological? Have they always presented this way? Or is the stress of the divorce really kind of throwing them for a loop and they are not looking their best?
Right. I mean, you guys, you have to look at the history and the patterns, but I mean, there's no question, no one would deny the impact of disturbance in the family to that extreme is certainly going to change people's, just we all react differently under severe pressures and stress. Talk to us about psychological testing.
Great. So that's kind of a piece of what you would do in a parental fitness or a child custody evaluation. But again, the importance of that, you know, like Amy and David have been saying, is the testing for the psychologist is just a piece. Just like the guardian is talking to multiple collateral sources, might be reviewing records, arrest records, DUI records, getting drug tests, whatever the specific situations are. We add in psychological testing, which can include some personality measures, some parenting inventory, some substance abuse things. But again, it's just a piece of the overall picture. It helps us kind of generate hypotheses. It lets us know kind of what to follow down and follow up on and get some confirming or disconfirming data for. So it is a piece, but it's not the end all be all. If someone doesn't test very well, that doesn't necessarily, it's not conclusive of what we might recommend for custody.
Right.
And so, Amy, talk about the psychological testing versus the guardian ad litem and custody evaluations. And how does that play in, you know, or where do you use that?
Well, as Allison was saying, the psychological testing is just one piece of the puzzle. So that definitely gives some feedback. A lot of times as a guardian, we work very closely with the psychologist to get their feedback. Sometimes there are behaviors that we as a guardian might observe in the parent or hear about from our collateral sources. The children tell us mom or dad does this, or we hear from other witnesses, family members, teachers, coaches, people that come in contact with the children about behaviors. And then that is a piece that we then try to compare and contrast to the psychological testing results. Again, we're trying to determine, as Allison was saying, whether this is a trait that this person has or whether they're just reacting to a very stressful situation. I mean, we are seeing a lot of times really good people behaving poorly because
right. There was a TV show about that, wasn't there?
Exactly. Because of the stress of the situation they're in. A divorce is very, very stressful. And then you add the extra layer when you're telling someone, you know, we're going to decide how much you're going to get to see your child. There's nothing more stressful than that, I don't think.
And just a little further about the psychological testing, how in-depth does it go? Is it just an afternoon kind of test, or is it a series of tests over a few days?
It depends on the questions that are presented, which is it's really helpful when you have attorneys or a guardian in the case that can really hone in. This is what I'm concerned about, so you don't have to cast as wide a net. But usually the battery we tend to give takes about 2.5 or 3 hours and consists of some personality measures and some parenting stress inventories.
I think the lawyer needs to work very carefully and closely with the client before the interviews with the guardian ad litem, have them create a life history or a story of their marriage, who takes the child to the doctor, who does the homework, who interacts with the child's friends. It's more than just psychological testing. It's really an overall evaluation of what's in the best interest of the child, considering numerous factors.
Yeah, and including, you know, we watch guardians do too. The parents actually interact with the kids. You know, guardians do home visits. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive thing. And I tell people all the time and tell attorneys all the time, my evaluation begins the second your client walks into my office. So if they're glancing sideways at my assistant or being rude to someone in the waiting room, I'm taking all of that in. It's not just about when they're in the room with me. So you do want to prepare them and let them know you're under a microscope right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very complicated. There's lots of layers you've got to undo and get to the bottom to find out what's the best for the children, the family, and how complicated does it get when there's multiple kids involved in the family?
very complicated. There can be new spouses. There can be stepsisters, stepbrothers. You know, if someone's going through a second divorce, they're the kids they came into the marriage with. There might be kids that they had in the marriage together. So,
oh yeah, we didn't even talk about blended families or whatever, right?
Yeah, that's the modern society now. You know, families moving across states, different siblings. You know, stepsisters, brothers. You know, and so you factor all that in though when making your decisions.
And we're also trying to look at not just what is happening right now while they are under the microscope. We really try to look at historically, as David was saying, who was the parent who was the primary caregiver, who did typically take them to the doctor appointments, deal with the school, go to parent conferences, do things like that. Not who does it now when we're under a microscope and is trying to be a super parent, but who has historically been the caregiver of the children.
That makes sense. And so for David, I have a question. When you've evaluated all this and you've realized that neither parent is fit to continue custody of the children, when do you decide, though, to bring that third party in who may need to take custody over the natural parent?
Usually the third party would intervene in the action and seek custody of the child by him or herself. It's normally a very close family relative. Sometimes the third party interjects when there's been a death of one of the natural parents and the surviving parent really doesn't have sufficient parenting skills. So it's still ultimately a best interest test, but there is a legal presumption in favor of a natural parent over a third party. So it's going to have to be a very serious situation where a third party or somebody other than the natural parent has custody.
Yes, got to be one of those cases that it goes to extremes in a lot of sense. It's not a very easy decision to make that the natural parent should no longer have custody.
It's very seldom that a natural parent would win over a third party would win over a natural parent unless there's unfitness or severe detriment to a child.
Wow. No, that makes sense. We want to keep the families together. That's ultimately what your job and your mission is to create the most peaceful, simple family structure that you can provide. It's not as easy as it sounds, of course, but, that's your main goal, right?
I often send families to somebody like Dr. Hill before a divorce action even starts to try to work with the parents in transitioning from a married state to a divorce state for the best interest of a child.
What about a mediator how many, I don't know if they have a statistic, but of people that, do reach this point of impact and they're looking to separate, how often can they come reunite and kind of fix, the situation and avert, the divorce? Or in most cases, by the time they come to y'all, it's probably game over or?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, at some time when, as David was saying, when a client comes to me, I spend a lot of time in that first conference talking about how they got there, to that point of coming to see a divorce lawyer. And I certainly recommend that they seek counseling and try everything that they can, especially when there's children. It's unfortunate when any marriage ends, but if there are not children involved, it's obviously less traumatic.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But if there are children involved, I mean, I've had people say, "Oh, my kid's older. It does, it's not going to matter because my kids are older." It matters.
When they say older, what are they talking, like high school or into college or just teenagers?
You hear people say that, "Well, when my child graduates high school, it's going to be okay."
Right.
"When my child graduates college, it's okay." And I tell people, I'm married with children of my own. If my parents got divorced, that would be traumatic for me.
Well, especially when they go up to college, because you think, okay, now they're out of the house, empty nesters, possibly, but they're off to college. Those are very stressful times for that's a new part of their life cycle, and now you're adding that stress of back what's going on, the drama back at home. But I want to kind of go back to this question of not all marriages obviously can be saved. In a lot of cases, especially when you're involving kids, many times it's better for them, if they're not. But what are some of the key indicators, I imagine off the top of the list, reasons for divorce? Obviously, infidelity, financial issues, money issues, right? But if they're going through a job loss and something that they've been together 10, 15 years, and this just kind of like cuts them, hits them like a ton of bricks, if they can resolve that financial issue, could they kind of reconvene? And
well, I think that's an individual decision. Yeah. I mean, that's what I tell people. It's good to go to counseling. You should try counseling.
Right.
You should try everything possible to save the marriage. But no one can make, it's a very individual decision. Yeah, no one can make that decision for you. And ultimately, some people reach a point of no return. Oh, so we've gotten to this point, things have happened, and now I'm just done. And
sometimes they find out they're better.
Oh, yeah.
Better friends.
Happily divorced, right? Yeah.
I often find that a good divorce, if you can ever have a good divorce, is better than a bad marriage, especially for the children.
Yeah.
Getting away from the turmoil, from the stress, from the arguments will help them establish a more healthy relationship as they get older.
Well, and I think family law attorneys have gotten very astute at recognizing whether they have a client that can be pretty reasonable, and maybe they and their soon-to-be ex-spouse could kind of come to the table and work out an agreement, or whether they're going to have a client that they're going to need to litigate. And sometimes I'll get a call from an attorney that says, can you meet with this couple for, you know, a couple sessions and see if, I say to people all the time, if we can come up with a parenting plan in my office, that's going to work better for you than a judge who doesn't know your family determining a parenting plan.
Yeah, we've
had some two reasonable parents, try it.
Yeah. I've heard some recent people say that, and that definitely resonates, makes sense. David, talk about relocation issues. I mean, we talked at the top of the show that you practice in Georgia and Florida and elsewhere, or primarily those two locales?
Right now, those are the two.
Okay. So what factors, I guess, should a court consider in determining whether a parent is permitted to relocate, from the non-custodial parent?
There's been a trend. Early on, relocation was almost always granted when the custodial parent wanted to relocate, as long as there was some good faith reason. But there's a growing trend that that a parent can't really offer quality substitute visitation, especially for a very small child. So you have to balance out. Say the custodial parent wants to relocate for a new job or a remarriage, and the new spouse has been relocated with a very good job opportunity. So is there a substitute time sharing or visitation schedule that would compensate for the parent being moved? So you have a lot of factors that have to go into the equation. Quality time sharing, affordability of the time sharing or visitation, is there going to be substitute time sharing, extended times during the holidays, things like that. If it's a good faith reason, generally relocation is granted if there is a substitute time sharing plan that can work. I think that has really been some of the toughest decisions for a judge to make, whether to grant relocation or not.
I agree. I think that that's very hard. I mean, from a legal perspective, they look at the move is a substantial change of circumstances, which is the prerequisite to get back into court to potentially modify custody and parenting time. And so the issue is that the parent can go. The court can't prevent the custodial parent from going. The question is, are the children going? So parents often say, well, I'm not going to go if I can't take my child, but the court can't really prevent the parent from going. But I think a big factor that the court looks at, number one, is why are they going? So if they're going just because I'm sick of dealing with my ex and I want to just get out of here, the court is more inclined to say, fine, you can go, but the children are going to stay. But as David was saying, I think the court looks at, is there a real reason to go? Are they going for a job move, or they going for something else? And then I think the court also looks at what has been the involvement of the other parent. So if the non-custodial parent hasn't been that involved, they have really less of an argument to say, well, I want her to stay with the kids here, but you didn't really see them that much anyway.
All right. I'd like to remind our listeners that you are listening to Atlanta Legal Experts, brought to you by Buckhead Business Radio and sponsored in part by 3A Law Practice Management, John Marshall Law School of Atlanta, and Peachtree Offices. We'd like to thank those sponsors for making this program happen. And this will be the portion where I give my opinion on divorce. It's just way too easy.
Easy there, buddy. Yeah.
Too easy for folks to
get it. We have professionals here in the room. Yeah.
You know, I'm a child from a broken home, and I certainly remember acting out as a youth because my parents didn't get along. You know, I grew up to be okay for the most part. But maybe you could speak to that on a little bit. And you know, do you challenge folks out there to try to work it out? You've mentioned counseling. You've mentioned other resources they can seek. But doesn't that speak to society in a bit today? David, what do you think?
Well, from the initial consultation, if it appears to be numerous issues, parenting issues, financial issues, business valuation issues. What I try to do is separate the issues, although they're all combined in the ultimate divorce. Often I reach out to a parenting coordinator or a psychologist to come up with what is a workable plan for the children in advance while I'm working on the business valuation issues with an accountant or a business valuator or somebody, a pension evaluator or an actuary. Things like that can be separated. Let's get a plan, a team effort to work this thing out. I think number one, children's issues always come first.
Absolutely.
And get the kids in with a good professional. Get the parents in with a parenting coordinator that help will look at the school schedules. Look at extracurricular activities. Dad says, I want him to play softball, baseball. Mom says, no, we're going to do swimming and dancing. So it's just too much for children up front. Get them in with qualified professionals and let's come up with a team concept.
But I like what the comment was made earlier. It is, I do subscribe to that premise that a happy divorce, if you say it, is a lot better than a bad marriage, you know. I think a lot of times that is an inclination because maybe not so much now, but I think in the past it was that stigma of like, well, we're going to stick it out through thick and thin no matter what for the sake of the kids, right? And I think we've all kind of seen that not play out well, and we've just determined that, you know, I don't think it's a knee-jerk reaction. Well, we're having some financial issues and, you know, we're stressed out, so let's just part ways, right? That's not, you know, because I think all other things considered, it is better to have a two-parent household, right, for the kids' benefit, but not if they're dysfunctional, right? But I'm a little bit of a diatribe here, but I'm in conclusion is that, but if they can separate, I know some friends and folks that are separated, have been divorced, but they're probably, the whole ecosystem for that family unit is better off. I mean, it's kind of, you know, seems like a incongruency there, but that's kind of the reality. Yes or yes?
Yes, I think that's what I was trying to say before, that I think that the couple has to investigate and think through all their options, going to counseling, talking through the issues, and trying everything to be sure, as you were saying, that it's not just we're going through a tough time because of whatever. I think all marriages, if you're married for a long time, anyone would admit, even in a good marriage, you have ups and downs when you're married for a long time. So people need to decide, are we just going through a rough time for whatever reason, or is this really a reason we need to go our separate ways? And ultimately, if they've tried counseling, they've tried everything, sometimes the marriage does need to end, but that doesn't mean it needs to be ugly, and it can end amicably with the help of professionals.
Yeah, is it a speed bump or is it a cliff, right?
Well, and don't forget, I say to parents all the time, kids are like little barometers. So if there's tension in the air at home, they're picking up on it.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have parents who say to me all the time, oh, the kids have no idea. And I meet with the kids, and they're like, oh, mom's doing this, dad's doing that. You know, the kids.
Well, even if they don't verbalize it, they have a sixth sense, right?
Absolutely. And so if the stress and tension in the household is staying super high, that's not going to be better for the kids.
Okay, a few more questions, but let's just interject real quick and go around the table one more time. And if you would like to share, you know, your contact information for listeners that are tuning in, as well as live, as well as the podcast, and I want to find out and reach out to you. So, Amy, if you want to just remind our listeners that you can give out phone number, email, website, you know, the nearest Starbucks you're going to be at tomorrow, whatever.
Sure. Well, I'm with Ellis Funk. And we practice all over the metro area. And our website is www.ellisfunk.com. And our phone number is 404-233-2800.
All right. Allison?
Yep. I'm Allison Hill. I'm with Peachtree Psychological Associates. And our phone number is 404-352-4348.
And your website is PeachtreePsychological.com.
All right.
Thank you.
Man, this guy's
a
genius.
Know that.
Yeah, he's
little
a little
research crack research department over here.
Yeah. All right, David.
I'm David Garfinkel. I practice with Levine, Smith, Snyder, and Wilson. Our phone number is 404-237-5700, and the website is www.lsswlaw.com.
And I'm Rich Casanova, richcasanova.com, but don't call or go to my website. No. All right, here we go. So in our final minutes here, maybe a little roundtable or any points we left off the table, or if, Ryan, you want to interject or just open panel, you know, thoughts or observations, takeaways, reflections, insights?
Well, I have something that comes into my office a lot, and I think Amy or David would speak better. But I often have grandparents coming in asking, you know, how do I get to see my kids and or my grandchildren and during this process, and what is my role? And I can help them psychologically, but legally, I think it might be helpful to hear kind of what grandparents' options might be and when they might need to seek their own counsel.
Well, basically, the law is that parents have the right to raise their children free from state interference. So basically, that means that the court's not going to just order that you have to let your parents or in-laws see the grandchildren. However, there are ways for a grandparent to seek visitation with the children. And mainly, as David was saying before, the overriding test in any of these custody visitation cases are what is in the best interest of the children. So there are cases sometimes where the children are very bonded to the grandparent already, and then for some reason that the parent's going to come in and try to sever those ties. So if the grandparent can show, well, that would be detrimental to the child who's very bonded to that grandparent already, to take that grandparent out of the children's lives, that would be a reason for the grandparent to be able to seek through the court's visitation. But in general, courts are reluctant to start dictating how parents raise their children.
It's really a constitutional issue. It's a right of privacy where a grandparent should not be allowed, or the courts feel that grandparents should not be allowed to interject themselves in a situation where the natural parents don't want the grandparent involved. So in an intact marriage, it's very hard for a grandparent to have access to the child when the natural parents don't want the grandparents involved.
Well, at the end of the day, it is the natural parent. So you open those floodgates, all of a sudden it's the aunts, the uncles, you know, right, the neighbors, you know, we've been best friends with the mom for, you know, 100 years. And it's like, you know, where does the floodgate, you know, how do you close that? So I guess it just pretty much begins and ends at the natural parent, right?
Normally, that's correct.
Okay. I want to go back to this relocation issue about, you know, I mean, hypothetically, if the parental parent, the person's been assigned custody, what's to prevent them from saying, you know, I have a job transfer and they transfer me to Hawaii? I mean, they can, you know, just request it and not release this information, or, you know, I'm moving to New York because I'm being transferred. How can you argue that point of just saying, well, they work for Xerox here, now they're going to work for Xerox in New York?
I think where the court looks, you, number one, you do give 30 days notice. Now, sometimes by agreement, but you have to give more notice. But now, okay, so the notice is out there. And
I'd wait 30 days to take my kids to New York, whatever, right?
Well, but the thing about it is now the court, so now you've had a substantial change of circumstances. So that's grounds for the modification. So now you're back in front of the court. You've met that prerequisite to get back in front of the court and reopen the issue of who should be the primary custodian. So now the question becomes, so is the parent who's leaving, have they actually been the primary caregiver?
Yeah, well, let's just for hypothetical reasons assume that's the case.
Okay. Right? So now you say, just for purposes of example, mom's been the primary caregiver.
Okay.
Dad has not been that active, but he's seen the child maybe every other weekend. Now mom says, I have a real reason to go. Now the question in your example is, well, did mom go to Xerox and say, please transfer me to Hawaii because I'm getting out of here? Or did they say, if you don't go to Hawaii, you're going to lose your job?
Or we're downsizing, or we're closing the Atlanta office.
So I think all those factors, do you really have to move, or are you just choosing to move? That's an important factor. And I think another factor is how active has dad been up to now before mom wants to leave? Maybe dad's been very, very active. And maybe that's a grounds to change custody to give the child the stability to stay here. And you say, mom, if you want to go, go, but the child's going to stay here.
Well, to David, to the court issue, does that judge just kind of have to glean through all this information and make a personality judgment, just interviewing and looking to the experts let's just assume, the dad is, they're somewhat equally involved, and how do you determine if it's legitimate?
I think there has to be a balancing of all kind of factors. When both parents are good parents, you look to what's in the best interest of the child. Older children, it's even a tougher decision. The child or the son is the star player on the high school football team, and all his friends are here, and all her classmates are active in their social clubs, and the child doesn't want to move. And So if mom's got a good job and Xerox transfers to Rochester, New York, and dad's got a good job here, and the children want to stay, especially a 14-year-old child has a more, the child can decide which parent, as long as one parent is fit, or both parents are fit. A 14-year-old in Georgia has a presumptive right to determine where the child wants to live, can make that election. So there's all kind of factors. And then the judge has to make a decision with the help of people like Amy and Allison as to what's in the best interest of the child.
I was going to kind of ask Allison that question. Is I did have that as a childhood, not divorce issues, but got moved around every, it seemed like from middle school to high school. I remember one time I went from middle school, I think, in eighth grade, and then high school I was... or seventh, and I was back in eighth grade in high school, and I got moved back to middle school or whatever. It's just like, it was kind of crazy times just moving around. But for kids, if they're, say, just in this hypothetical example, there's two kids, can one decide I want to stay, the other go?
We tend to look at it as pretty much a risk assessment, like might happen in kind of like a criminal assessment, right? What are the risks and benefits to each of these kids given the situation? And we take in a lot of parent and child factors, you know, like David was saying, what's going on with this kid here in town? What might they lose out on in terms of relationships and opportunities? But you also want to think about kind of, you know, the mental stability and the coping resources of the parent who's moving, because if that parent has had a co-parent in town that's done half of the carpooling and half of the driving and is now going to be in a new city with a new job alone, that might also impact their ability to parent and kind of be there for the kids. So we look at kind of, there's been, Austin has put out a framework of factors to be considered, but there's a series of them that we really look at and weigh the risks and benefits. And if the benefits of the move outweigh the risk, then we would recommend that. But if they don't, then we wouldn't.
So it does always come back to a it depends scenario, case by case.
Yeah, it's really not black and white, and that's what's hard, because a lot of parents come and say, you know, can I guarantee that my ex is not going to move away with the children, especially in the initial divorce? If I agree that my spouse can have primary custody, can you guarantee that he or she won't be able to ever move away with the children? And there are no guarantees. It's all very fluid, and the courts are looking at what is in the best interest of the child at that time. Georgia law used to be that there were provisions that you could put in to say prospectively what's going to happen or with a change, but the law has done away with that, and rightfully so, because I think you have to look at that moment, what is in the best interest of the children right now when the move is going to occur.
And one of the strongest predictors is the child's relationship to the relocating parent. So if you have a child that's very connected to that parent and that parent needs to move, you don't want to take that relationship away from the kid as well.
All right. So, David, you were talking about earlier about this child age issue of 14, but I had a kind of a broader question, and it may or may not be pertinent because we're, you know, discussing issues based here in Atlanta and Georgia. But any reference point in terms of we talk, you know, the whole issue has been about child and child custody. What about age issues as here in Georgia and other states? I guess it varies. 18 years old, I mean, at what point does a child come into play in determining some of these outcomes?
Well, that's part of the, I mean, the guardian, that's one of the big roles of the guardian, is to actually speak to the children. And that starts at a very early age. And to observe, as Allison was saying, the children with each parent and how they interact with the parent. The children can make their voices known. And under Georgia law, at 12, a child can speak to the court. Courts in general are, they rarely, if ever, do they put the child actually on the stand in a courtroom. There are some judges that will speak to children in chambers privately, sometimes with lawyers present, sometimes not. Usually they never make the child speak in front of the parents to the court. But usually that's the role of the guardian, so that the child doesn't have to come to court, that they speak to a guardian instead. Georgia law is that it used to be that a child at 14 could make an election, and the election was used to be binding on the court as long as the parent chosen was presently not unfit. Now the law has changed that there is a presumption in favor of that election of a child at 14. It's a rebuttable presumption. So really at 14, to answer your specific question, 14 is really the age where the child has a stronger voice, although I think they have a voice from an earlier age speaking to a guardian or speaking to a custody evaluator.
And I think that's such an important point that the law has changed in that. Because I get kids coming into my office all the time. Well, mom said I'm 14, so I can choose.
Right.
I just want to talk to the judge. Just let me. And setting your kids up for that is not going to be helpful right. in this process. And so whenever I have a 14-year-old that's like, I know I get to choose now. I'm like, well, where are you getting that information? Because
And I think that's important, too, as a guardian or a custody evaluator to look behind why that choice is being made. I mean, sometimes you see, this parent basically has no rules at their house, so that's why I want to go live there. Or this parent promised me a car as soon as I'm 16, and that's why I want to choose this parent. So it's important to see the relationship between the parent and child and the motivation for the child making the election they may make.
That's a key point, because if there's, you know, promises on the table, or, you know, I mean, they're tugged, you know, it's a tug of war situation. And this is a whole new topic. I don't know. We're almost out of time for the show here, but David,
it's the concept of the Disneyland dad. A child gets a car or gets whatever he wants, gets to stay out late.
Right.
It's still a best interest test. Although the child at 14 can make an election, the judge can oversee it and override that election if it's not in the child's best interest. That's one of the areas of law that I had to learn differently when I moved to Georgia. Because in Florida, the child cannot make an election, cannot decide where the child wants to live. It's only a factor.
Right.
There's much more of a presumption in Georgia based on the child's election, subject to the best fitness test.
Right.
But in Florida, it's only one of many factors.
Well, and if I can just say one thing, developmentally, adolescents are primed to be manipulative. So even in intact families, they would play mom and dad off each other. So if we set up a situation where they're ping-ponging back and forth based on what they're getting or getting away with in different households, it can be very detrimental to the
and
child.
Difference of maturity levels between the genders, right?
Absolutely.
If you're just listening to the radio, everybody in the studio nodded their head. Yeah.
Right. Adolescents don't just make bad decisions. They make decisions badly. Their brains are not developed to make
And one point we didn't even touch on, and I'm almost hesitant to bring this up because we're almost out of time, but I don't know if everybody can just kind of give a quick response to this, if it's reasonable. This whole generation, the social media element comes into play, right? I mean, there's a lot of conversation that happens amongst the parents and in-laws. We could do a whole show just on in-laws, right? We kind of touched on it with the grandparents, what have you, right? But what's the play of social media between the kids, their peers? Now, you know, the Facebook interaction. What's the legal ramifications? Can the court look into the history of what's been going on in conversation? Because a lot of times those are more real conversations, right?
I often tell my clients, I almost always tell them, when you put something on Facebook or when you put something, text it or
email
or tweet it, you might as well start it off saying, "Dear Judge,"
oh, really?
Because it is some of the best evidence that you could present in court. Or the stupidity of the irrational things that people post.
Well, you talked about a criminal case analogy, but that kind of comes into play here, right? Is that social media? That's a great line. I've never heard that. You might as well say it instead of "Dear John, Dear Judge." But is all of that admissible? I mean, how do they? I don't get into. They have access to all that,
as long as a reliable foundation is presented to the court that this is accurate, you can tie it into the other person. Certainly, the photographs are subject.
It's hard to deny those unless Photoshop, but you have to go to quite an extent to kind of.
It's some of the lawyer's best tools.
Well, and you know, and when we were talking about before, in cases where there might be some alienation, you often have kids who have cell phones that are getting messaged when they're with the parent they don't like spending time with constantly from the parent that doesn't want them to be with that parent. And often those text messages are even discoverable.
Oh,
so if
time.
The other parent's sending the kid, your dad is the worst, things like that, then that can all come in too and can be shown that the parent really is trying to do some withholding of
That's
the relationship.
That's probably a better key indicator than he said, she said, right?
That's a big issue that comes up in the custody cases. And it's a fine line because you say when the child is away from the other parent, so the parent they're not then with should be able to communicate with them.
Right, yeah.
But how much should they be able to communicate with them? And that is a very fine line. So do we have one call a day? how many texts a day? Well, if we're having a conversation via text, then it could be multiple texts, but is there a limit where we've crossed the line? Now you're just texting the child all day while the child's with me and you're interfering with my time with the child. It's a tough
balance. Oh, that's very dicey because, I mean, we think before the internet, right, none of this came into play. It was the only visitation was face-to-face or a phone call, but you could easily turn off the answering machine. Do you remember answering machines?
Right.
All right, Ryan, I think we're out of time, I believe, here, right? Wow, this just flew.
It just goes by so quickly when we're talking about hot-button legal issues like this that involve families, that involve custody, that involve just, you know, all these elements that, you know, we were talking about here today. So you're right. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we're going fast. We will like to thank our sponsors one more time. You've been listening to Atlanta Legal Experts, sponsored in part by 3A Law Practice Management. That's helping lawyers start and grow their practice in places like Atlanta and all over the Southeast, from what I've recently learned. Also, Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, where they're training young legal professionals there on a consistent basis, and Peachtree Offices. Thank you to them for making all this happen. And thank you to Buckhead Business Radio X and Mr. Rich Casanova.
You're welcome.
For all of the great conversation we had here today and that we have every Tuesday here on Atlanta Legal Experts.
Absolutely. And we'll see everyone next week here on the radio on AL Radio.